If he had had Charles Dickens to draw on, Herod might have described this as a Scrooge moment. You know, he's telling his therapist, while we're reimagining our history, how scared he was. He was telling him how scared he was. And she asks, "Did you see a ghost?" And Herod stares at the ceiling, hesitating. "Well, no, I didn't see him, but I knew he was coming for me." And the therapist notices the curious choice of words. "Why would he be coming for you? Do you know him?" she asks. "Of course I know him. I had him killed." And the words leap out. His ashen face and vacant stare reveal where his mind is going. Back piece by piece to that moment. He starts with the justifications. Those cascading events which made the end seem inevitable. "I just wanted to get married, but he got in the way." How did he get in the way? "He said we couldn't get married." "Why?" "Well, he said I couldn't marry Herodias because she was my brother's wife. And I get that it's unorthodox." "Is that what he called it? Unorthodox?" "No. He said it was not lawful. But I'm the king, so I make the laws." "Is that why you had him killed? Because you're the king?" "No, no, that isn't. I was mad, frustrated. He was getting in the way, but I didn't. You know, I liked listening to him. After I put him in prison, of course, I'd sit and we'd talk. It's silly, but it kind of reminded me of Pharaoh and Joseph." "You listened to him?" "Yeah, he'd talk about God and repentance. I could just hear the holiness in his voice. He could speak like no other." "Do you think that's why he thought he could tell you not to marry your brother's wife, that it wasn't lawful? What do you think he meant by that?" "Well, I know he wasn't talking about civil law. He was talking about God's law. But I was so livid. I wasn't thinking. I had him arrested. But I didn't have a plan after that. Prison was about punishment, but it was also just getting him out of the way, getting him out of my hair for a while. I never meant." "You know, he keeps talking. Do you want to tell me what happened?" "It was my birthday. We had all these people over, and you can imagine the scene, how birthdays always go. There's a banner, happy birthday, there's streamers and balloons, there's a cake decorated on the table. We always made a big deal about the cake with the candles, didn't we? It was a party, you know, the balloons were colored like the rainbow. The red wine flowed, our cheeks flushed rosy. I think there were colors of the rainbow, right? I don't actually remember now. But we were laughing, and I asked her to leave her friends for a minute and come and dance. She loved to dance. She was so graceful. I see that in my dreams when I see her, you know? I see her dancing. That's where I'm at night, dreaming, seeing this dancing. And I don't know if it was the red wine or the fact that she's my little girl. And I'd give the world for her. But I promised her I'd make all her dreams come true if she just asked. My present to her. And I didn't know why she left. I mean, it seemed so strange. I expected something so impulsive, like, I want a pony, right? But she was only gone a minute, and When she got back, something was different. She was different. She didn't glide like she does. I can't explain it, but she stepped. Her steps were smooth and elegant, like she was a cat, like a lioness. Really, she looked just like her mother. And she declared in front of all of our friends that the one thing she wanted was the head of John the Baptizer. What was I supposed to do? I watched the color drain from the room. The guests, I know they were whispering and talking about me, saying I was losing a step, that I didn't have what it takes to rule, that I'm soft. I couldn't let them think that. I couldn't let them think I wouldn't keep a promise. My word is my bond, right? I had to. There was no choice. So I sent my guards down to the prison, and we waited. I don't remember anything except the time stopping. Why does it do that? It was the longest moment of my life, and yet I don't really remember anything about it. It took forever. And you know, in my dreams, fill that in, right? That when I remember it, there's this dreaming it, there's this cat prowling around the room, and for some reason, I'm focusing on this one little kid who's trying to untie the balloons from the chair, and he's focused on this one red balloon. Anyway, so the guards come back in with the platter, and I swear to God that for a second, I thought they had brought out the lamb. I just don't know where my head was. But I knew what it was. I'm sure I knew. And when I saw it, I didn't realize how much blood would be there. I almost excused myself. It's just, I had them give it to her. And she took it and she left. It was surreal. Where did my little girl go? Where did she go? I found out later that she took the head to her mother. I knew I was angry, but I'm the king, right? So I don't need to worry about it, but I didn't know that I knew she was mad. I just didn't see it. I really do wish Herod had a therapist. Of all the people in the New Testament, he needed one. If he had, oh, how things might have been different. But of all the stories in Mark, this is such an odd interlude, isn't it? It isn't directly about Jesus. And it comes right after the disciples are empowered by Jesus to go out and heal and exorcise demons. And right after this, they'll come back having done just that. But Jesus is here. He's just obscured by Herod's fear of John, of God bringing John back as a testimony against him. But it's not clear in the way that the healing stories are clear, or like last week, how Jesus went home and was treated with such distrust. So why is this story here? What's Mark really getting at? As the story unspools, we hear these ridiculous self-justifications from a king who didn't want to kill John, But he felt trapped. All these people with all their different desires. Managers and executives know this feeling. Judges, officers, mothers, fathers, every person who has to deal with other people knows this feeling. That feeling of helplessness when you know what the right thing really is, but all these other voices cloud our vision. And in that moment, we get lost. And like getting turned around in the forest, we think this must be the right path, so we take it. As unsettling as the whole story is, the most disturbing line in the text isn't about his head. It actually comes when Herod is making the decision. The king was deeply grieved, yet out of regard for his oaths and for the guests, he did not want to refuse her. So he did it. What he didn't want to do, what he knew he shouldn't do. Where is his priority? I mean that literally. I mean, remember, the word priority is singular. It's not just some ordering and ranking of events. It is, there is only one priority. So where is it, right? Is it found in his devotion to John, his daughter, his kingdom? Can we find it in his keeping an oath or honoring his guests or his lust for power? What is his priority? It's not really clear. In fact, it looks like he's acting without priority. But I'll tell you what it's not. He hasn't made God his priority. A God who is love, right? A God who was revealed to him in the voice of the image of John the Baptizer, who spoke of repentance and turning toward God. The story is far less strange when we consider just how geared Mark is toward the good news of Jesus the Christ. How often the author reveals how beautiful the kingdom looks through Jesus' eyes, and how distorted and gruesome our culture can look through those same eyes. Mark gives us the story, I think, for the same reason he gives us an imperfect Peter and constantly failing disciples. Why the focus is often on human failures to see God's work in the world. Mark gives this story such rich detail because it isn't a throwaway scene, but integral to seeing how mixed up we can get when we're blinded by loyalty to our families, lust to our libidos, and thirst for power, social pressures to conform, fears of what our friends will think. It's not a story just of propaganda or a paranoia or simply contextual history. Mark doesn't do that. Mark's writing to people who want power or are being pressured to honor an oath. When Jesus says to not swear oaths at all, he's writing to people like us who need to see what we look like. And people who want to follow Jesus and sometimes get distracted by all the stuff and all of the expectations we put on each other. Because we do this all the time. We even do this with our church, with our tradition, don't we? We get caught up in our fears, and our vision gets clouded. We think we're protecting it from change, but we're not. We're people whose priority is easily clouded, a priority to love. Of all the things, right, an oath to give his daughter whatever she wants? Fear of what the guests might think if he doesn't kill somebody? That's not love. You know, I think maybe Herod just needs to go see King Lear. Maybe that's what he needs. A therapist and King Lear, and he'll be set. But if we learn from Herod, if we learn what could have been, we can find it again. He liked listening to John. If we follow him back to hear his ridiculous justifications for doing something so terrible, then we might hear how lost he was, how much he needed someone to say no. Then go back further to the beginning and hear it again. John the Baptizer appeared in the wilderness, proclaiming a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins. This is what I'm sure he was listening to. Herod was being pulled to love, to a way of repentance and mercy. He could hear it, and he could almost see it. And so in our listening, we might be moved to believe too. And then it becomes so much clearer. It doesn't matter what they think. At the center is the Word, and he reminds us our priority. Love God. And loving your neighbor is loving God. Even now, it's not too late to love.